Hey, everybody, I'm Paul Yeager. This is the MTOM Show podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Today, we are going to get into a topic that has been coming up more and more during our market analysis segment, as well as Market Plus. It is about the country of India. Is it an emerging market? Is it a market that the United States can count on to ship grain? Well, we'll ask a person who was just there and his business is trading. Seems like a perfect combo. Also seems like a good time to bring back one of our guests. That's Jordan Fife. He's based in the Houston, Texas area. He just went to Houston, or he went from Houston to India, and we learn a little bit about that trip. But Jordan is the president of trading for BioEurasia, which is a company that's actually owned by a group in India. So we'll find out about those relationships and what he has discovered from a set of American eyes when he is there. So that is our topic today. We hope you enjoy this episode, like all the others, that comes out on Tuesday. You're an interesting follow on X or Twitter, whatever you want to say. You're in a very tech industry, but you also have some old school charts. I love looking at numbers. You've been in the energy, you're in the energy business, but there's been some energy charts that have caught your attention recently. What are they?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Paul. Appreciate it. One of the things that I like to do is go back in time and look at world events that are similar to the current events that are happening. And obviously, the big one that is shaping energy right now is the conflict in Israel. What does it mean if we look back, and how do we extrapolate that into the future? And the two most similar conflicts that we've faced in recent times are the first Iraq War and the second Iraq War. And if you look back on the first Iraq War, which was in 1990, we had an increase from $17 to $40. And some of that was almost overnight, happened very quickly. The second Iraq War in 2003 and 2004, it happened on a longer time frame to increase. But we had a 63% increase in oil. So you look at that and say, what's it mean for us now? We're sitting at about $81 per barrel of oil. So if you increase between 43% and/or 63%, you're looking at like $130 per barrel of oil. And then what does that mean on the street to the people who are buying gasoline at the pump? It means like a $4 something handle, depending on which state you're in, how the taxes work and everything like that, which would obviously be bad for the economy, which would be bad for all things considered for the United States. So we're trying to figure out how big is this conflict going to get? What is its reach? And that is what I think most energy traders are focused on right now.
One of the big firms, not an energy firm, but a trading firm, right after the invasion or the bombing started, was oil is going to go well over 100 in just a short amount of time. Didn't happen. Do we have a different world supply than, say, we did in 1991, than 2003, 2004, than what we have in 2023? And that's maybe why the market didn't respond as violently?
Absolutely. So specifically, if you look at the United States, right, there's two different oil indices that most people follow. There's WTI and there's Brent, West Texas Intermediate and Brent, which is off the north shore of Scotland. And those two can react differently depending on what the world events are. But we're going to focus real quick on WTI, West Texas Intermediate. Back in 1990 and everything like that, we were importing 24-25% of our oil from Saudi Arabia, from Venezuela, countries like that. Fast forward to currently, and the United States is the largest oil producer in the world. That's a fact that just gets lost on people for some reason, and one that the United States doesn't do a great job. And I'm not going to, if you follow me on Twitter or X or whatever you call it, I don't like to get into politics. I really don't. But if you're a Republican, you don't want to say that we're the number one producer of oil, because that means that, we've done a good job of producing. They like to say drill, baby, drill. If you're liberal, you don't like to say we're the world's largest producer of oil, because it's a bad thing, because we're digging in the ground and we're doing all this bad stuff to the environment. So both sides, the United States really doesn't toot their own horn. So that is one of the major differences between back then and now. Is we are the number one oil producer. On top of that, as I previously mentioned, we are importing 24-25% from Saudi Arabia, another 15-20% from Venezuela. We don't do that anymore. The people that we import from, Canada, number one at 60%. And then another 10% from countries we import from is Mexico. So 70% of our imports are coming from neighboring countries that we're extremely friendly with. So the WTI portion of the oil equation is vastly different. And then on a world front, again, you're going to get into different flows and everything like that, pipelines, how they've been built, treaties that have been signed. It's just a very different world. However, Brent will be more affected. Europe will be more affected. Asia will be more affected by these wars in the very short term. Overall, the rising tide will lift both boats. The spread between WTI and Brent can only get so wide. But I think that's probably in the short term what's going to happen more is the Brent will rise more in relative than the WTI.
I also think of WTI of the challenges of finding new sources in the United States. That has we've looked at North Dakota and the Bakken region, and I'm not saying it's emptying, but it's less than an influence that it once was. And then you have energy policies from the White House right now that are on the green front. But as you said, we're getting a lot of oil into this country. And we're also with trading partners. A lot gets talked about on this program about China. But it's really the North American countries that we trade and do a lot of business with. You're really close to Mexico where you're at, closer than I am, and I'm closer to Canada than you are.
That's right.
Are relations the same when it comes to oil, when it does to commodities like beef, cattle, and corn and soybeans?
Yeah, I mean, there's some pretty big differences there when you do deal with oil. But the oil sands out of Canada is that they need us as a buyer. We need them as a supplier. It is a very symbiotic relationship. It differs slightly, and I don't need to tell you or a lot of people in your audience how that differs for commodities like soybeans or corn or anything like that. I mean, we have South America sitting just to the south of us, right? And they are a constant presence in just producing more and more agricultural products every single year. They're in their growth phase, and they're looking for a home. And one of them is North America and our trading partners, which, you know, is Canada and Mexico. So it's more of an intrusive from the agricultural standpoint coming in from the south, whereas they're the supplier, Mexico and Canada, to the United States, and we're the buyer. And we hold a lot of cards. Also, the dollar is the driver of this. Oil trades in the dollar, which helps us a lot in a lot of scenarios. So it is different in that sense that they need to sell to us.
Shh, your bosses aren't going to hear this. Have we hit peak oil in the United States? Our consumption
production
of it? Our consumption of it?
Yes. If not, we're within, you know, an earshot of it. But that's not really that big of a deal. I really don't think it is.
You don't?
We're not going to go all. No, I don't. I don't. Because, I mean, electrical-wise, it's not going to make sense to go all electrical for a while. I am in Texas, as you noted. As you guys remember, we all froze a couple years ago and our grid went under. We are an independent grid. The Texas grid is completely independent of the United States, which is a unique thing unto itself. But if you use that as an example, our infrastructure has to be massively increased to increase electric vehicles to a point of which it's over 10%, 15%. The numbers just aren't there. You know, I had one friend of mine that worked at a gasoline station. Well, he doesn't work at a gasoline station, but he works for a large gasoline station company. And he told me that one of the Porsches, the electric, all electric Porsches, if you come in peak hours to fill that thing up from zero, it takes more electricity to fill that thing up from zero to full than it does to generate all of the power for the entire gas station. That's all the pumps, all the refrigeration, all the air conditioning, every other thing that powers this massive gasoline station. That one Porsche will draw more energy off of the grid. So that really doesn't bother me that much. But as far as peak oil consumption goes, our cars are getting more efficient. There are hybrids out there. I honestly think the hybrid model is probably better than the all electric. And the internal combustion engine will not cease to exist in North America within the next, you know, within our lifetime. But when I look at Asia and I look at India and I look at those places, I mean, India has 1.4 billion people. The 0.4 is larger than the entire United States, and they're industrializing at a rapid rate. There's going to be a home for hydrocarbons that come out of a refinery. So what that means, really, in my opinion, and it's already happening, but I think it's going to increase. The United States will be further and further into exporting hydrocarbons, whether that's diesel or gasoline, to the rest of the world. We have an extremely efficient refining capacity and system down in the Gulf of Mexico, all the way from Louisiana, all the way over to Texas. And it's set up to do that. And again, I've imported and exported out of South America. It's just easier to do it out of North America, out of the Gulf of Mexico.
We, though, haven't built a new refinery in the United States in decades. And are there any new ones coming online, or are we just getting more efficient operations?
I think it's the latter. And, you know, and I've heard that, obviously, we've all heard that. We haven't built a new refinery in X, Y, and Z. And it's true. But we've retrofitted a ton. We've put new hydrotreaters, hydrocrackers in a lot of places. And we do continually have to keep up and improve the efficiencies of these refineries. That being said, eventually you're going to have to, you know, rebuild some of these. I don't know when that will be. I don't know. It's going to be very hard, whatever administration's in it. I mean, even if, you know, more right-leaning, easier to get things done in the Gulf of Mexico type of politicians, even then there's going to be somebody that holds out for something. Yep. It's just hard to do right now.
Yep. It's like a beef processing or a hog processing plant. Nobody wants it in their backyard, even though it might be needed for more stability. Ethanol-wise, where do you see that fuel fitting in this discussion of what you're talking about, globally and domestically?
So that's a big question right now. And one that, depending on who you ask, it's either really good or really bad, right? I tend to lean to really good. And the reason why is because of what we're seeing in the renewable diesel space. We're seeing all this investment, all these, back to hydrotreaters, hydrocrackers, you're seeing all these major oil refineries getting into the space of renewables, which is encouraging. You know, it used to feel like they were kind of the foe, even though they're the biggest, their biggest customer of renewables was the big oil companies. They kind of seem to, and for right reason, you know, that's, you walk in and someone says 10% of your demand is gone and it's going to go to this new product. Understandably, they're going to want to try to fight for that 10%. But now they're kind of rowing the boat in the same direction with this renewable diesel. They're buying soybean oil. They're buying fats. They're getting tallows. They're getting bean oil. There's corn oil. They're getting into the space of renewables. What does that mean for ethanol? Sustainable aviation fuel is the next logical leap. And sustainable aviation fuel right now, there is a push to use ethanol as a feedstock for sustainable aviation fuel. If that were to pass, we're off to the races. This is a whole new market to tap into, which would really help ethanol.
And that's what I've heard both said on our show by different folks who've come in from the ag side, commodity side, who see that as a possibility. Also, the administration, Secretary Vilsack, has made a big push in 2023 about sustainable aviation fuel. We're still...
And you look at the airlines, they have committed to it.
Yeah.
You go look, Southwest, Delta, they've all signed things by blank. We are going to have X amount in our, and there's only one way to do that. It's policy, and it's working with people, and it's guaranteeing that in these emerging markets, in these small, in these startups, not rather small, quite large, that there will be need for it next year. You can't put all your money in and expect to get it back in 1 year. It takes years to recover these billions and billions of dollars that they're going to be putting in. So you need a administration, whoever it might be, that's friendly to that and says, hey, we're going to be there for the next couple of years to make sure you guys get it off the ground. No pun intended.
Either way, it works. Puns work. They take off. Your employer, your checks come. You have a lot in India. You were just in India. I want to talk about that. When you mention emerging markets, we always talk about China. Where does India fit into this discussion right now?
From an energy standpoint, yes, I was just in India, and I did just say there's 1.4 billion people there, and I was in Delhi for a moment, and just seeing Delhi is like 34 million people. It's incredible. And Mumbai, I was there for a moment, it's like 35 million people. The state that Delhi is in is over 200 million people, and it's like 1.5 times the size of North Carolina. It's not a big place. There's so many people there. So obviously that means if they all start driving, there's huge demand there. They all start eating more proteins. There's huge demand there for the agriculture and everything like that. Even though a lot of India is vegetarian, there's other ways to get it in there. But they are emerging in a way that I think China, it's already happened. They're in that first wave of true industrialization over the last 10 years, how much they've invested in infrastructure, in highways to link Mumbai, New Delhi and all that. It's truly incredible to see. And then from an ethanol standpoint, obviously they only import industrial right now. They do not import fuel grade. If that were to ever change, that is the silver lining to every ethanol producer's cloud right now. If India were to step in and say, we want more ethanol, it would be a game changer. China used to import more, and now they're building their own ethanol plants. Currently, India has ethanol plants. They make it from molasses, from sugarcane, but it's just they don't have the infrastructure to do it. They could take more tomorrow. Modi, their prime minister, has also increased the amount of ethanol they do take into their cars. They're not hitting it right now, but the fact that they're trying to do it is encouraging. So you can either one of two things is going to happen, in my opinion. One, they eventually say you can import fuel, or two, they say, hey, could you come help us build these things and show us how to run them? Either way, I think it's going to be good for the U.S.
How long of a good for the U.S.? I mean, you talk a 5-year, a 50-year scenario there?
I mean, I don't think India's done growing. So really the question is, how long will they keep expanding? And I think they'll continue to do that for the next 20 to 30 years. Now, if they can industrialize that much and they do grow sugarcane and everything like that, they could potentially start making their own. So it just depends on the industrialization. You're going to need it near their populous areas. You're going to need to build these plants in and around Mumbai, New Delhi, Hyderabad, where there's major metropolitan areas to make a dent, or they need to increase their port cities to take in more and build tanks. It'll take some investment from somebody, but somebody's going to get it right and probably make a ton of money.
Infrastructure, to me, is always one of those big debates and challenges for India. What is it going to take for them to rapidly excel in improving roads, ports, plants, everything that's needed to get to this plan? How quickly, and what's their stomach and tolerance for it?
From what they have shown in the last 10 years, it seems like they have the stomach for it. Again, you know, just the vast improvements in India in the last 10 years is pretty shocking. And it's kind of rudimentary to you and I in the United States and everything like that. But from where they have come to where they have gone, and again, just the last decade is truly astonishing. And Modi seems to be driving it pretty well right now. I think that they, you know, if they can get access to cheap money is no longer. I think that's the biggest hindrance right now. If we can get the World Bank's back to a reasonable level, I think what they've showed us over the last decade, they'll continue in very, very similar fashion, but more democratic than China. And again, as a ally, they are a strong one. They are the largest democracy in the world. And that's something that we should be, as the United States, no matter who's in office, pushing for. This is a huge buyer of things. They're blessed with a lot of things in India, as Modi likes to say. Resources is not one of them. They need to come from somewhere. 80% of their energy is imported. Right now, that's being fulfilled by Russia and Saudi Arabia. If we could intervene in there in any way with hydrocarbons or whatever it is, that would really go a long way, I think, to fortifying that relationship.
But isn't India just looking for the cheapest option? Forget the geopolitical. Well, but we are too. But some of those decisions are challenged when they're like, I don't know if I want to buy from that country.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at Elon Musk, he's figured it out, right? I mean, where does mining for all this stuff come from? He lets another intermediary get in there and then he buys it from them and it doesn't look like he's doing it. There's ways around it. I mean, water always finds its level, right? And somebody is willing to wear the risk for you. You have to pay him for it. But at the end of the day, yes, India has decided to buy the cheapest, and you can't blame them. I mean, they have an opportunity here to increase their margins, to shorten the gap a little bit. I mean, they took it, and there's no laws against it. There's been talk of embargoes and everything like that. But you don't want to make a tense relationship with somebody when you're trying to get these relationships off the ground. So, I think there's still a way in there. But yes, until until they run out of cheap Russian oil, they're probably going to keep taking it. There's no way around that.
So it becomes a competitive, just like we always hear in grains, whoever's the cheapest is going to get the business. And
that's
India
right.
is going to abide by that rule. So in that sense, they are like the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
Geopolitical wise, America's not the only one that knows what's going on there and can look at the numbers of India. So what are you hearing about Russia's interest in maybe their ways in India, or China and their ways in India? And if we bankroll some of these things, where's Modi have to sit? Where do the people have to sit in that country to understand who's trying to influence decisions?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, Modi has met with, I think, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden now. I know he met with Trump. Trump went over there. Modi came over here. I don't know if Biden has met with him yet. Definitely needs to if he hasn't. But again, they're a democracy at the end of the day. And they are a very active democracy. Like, their voting turnout is like 98%. It's incredible. I don't think they're going to go the way of fascism and dictatorship. And I just don't think that suits them. However, if they're willing to, they have showed that they're willing to do business with those type of countries. And again, they are kind of on an island over there. They're in Asia. You know, a lot of people forget that it's Asia, and Asia is right next to the Middle East, and it's right next to Russia. So that's going to be the cheapest supply. I think they're more opportunistic than they are leaning that way politically. It then becomes the United States' job to offer them an alternative that, if it's not cheaper, is palatable. And if we can't do that, well, then I don't expect them to really follow through with any trade with us.
Do you see India importing more of our goods or our insight on goods? You talked about improving refineries, things like that. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I think the insight's probably the easier way. And look, you know, if you look at America right now, the way it's trending, tech is kind of one of our biggest exports, right? That's more idea-based than it is goods-based. You know, we've kind of shifted a little bit from raw materials and everything like that, you know, to a more tech-related economy. So I would expect that would continue to follow through. And it's an easier one, right? The goods is a harder one. Like we talked about, India does need to improve their ports. They cannot take in more if there's a bottleneck. So they need to work to the bottleneck that. Once they do that, I think there is a very good opportunity, again, to have some sort of trade agreement with them. Since they are in Asia, it's a natural draw to China. But China's not really a huge exporter either. You know, they're a large importer as well. So it really comes down to Russia and to the Middle East. And that's going to be more oil-based to begin with. As far as agricultural products go, I mean, it's South America that they're going to try to draw off as much as they can and then do as much as they can domestically. But I was there. I drove around in the country. I went to several farms. They've got a long way to go, a very long way to go. I mean, they really are still doing like water buffaloes and plows. That's not facetious at all. That's just the way it is right now in a lot of places over there. Camels and plows. I saw it with my own two eyes. Herds of sheep in the middle of a highway, grooming the middle of it, that they pay them to do. So again, it's got a long way to go. But if there is an alternative, they're very willing to listen to it. It just has to be within their budget.
Can their farms catch up rapidly? Do they have enough land that would allow them to maybe do some things internally in their country and not have to rely on importing from other countries?
They've got a lot of land. I drove from New Delhi to Agra, which is where the Taj Mahal is. It's like a 3.5-hour drive, and there was nothing between it. There was just farmland. That's all it was, you know, for a 3.5-hour drive. And again, they have land. Once you get further north, you get into the Himalayas, you're not going to grow anything there. But when you get further south, there's plenty of land. However, it then becomes water conservation and how much they're drawing. 1.4 billion people really do draw a lot of water. And on top of that, they have a pollution problem. They know that. They're very aware of it. The air quality there is poor, but also the water quality. So you have competing factors that you're going to have to mitigate somehow. I'm not sure how, and I'm not an engineer to figure that out. But it's a fact that they're going to have to figure out water. Not only quality, but where it's going to go. They do have a monsoon season, and then it kind of dries up. So they will be able to grow maybe right after that. But again, right now, very rural, very rudimentary. I don't think it's going to catch up within the next decade, but maybe the next 20, 30 years, sure.
As an American, what are my headlines or things and stories I'm supposed to follow out of India to just moving forward?
Where they're getting their energy from, who they're signing their treaties with, our ability to, again, to offer them something that makes sense, and what our efforts are. The longer we don't, the more somebody else will.
Do you anticipate that we are going to see India emerge from emerging nation status in the next 20 years?
I believe so, yes. You know, they had the G20 summit there. They've had the World Games there. They've had Indian, the IPL, the Indian Cricket League, and now they've expanded into having the World Cup of Cricket there. I think they'll get there. It's going to be difficult because, again, you know, 33 million people in a city and a fair amount of those in lower quality of life conditions right now. But I think they can do it, you know, just from the infrastructure that they've shown on the roadside, on logistics. It's improved so much in a decade that I think if you fast forward and getting that base foundation, now you can build up quickly, right? Relatively speaking. And I think they've almost gotten that base completed. So now the next pieces need to come into place. A big thing that's happening there is they're not tearing down homes and kicking people out. What they do is they say, okay, you're in an apartment complex that needs to be redone, refurbished. They pay for you to move. They refurbish it, but then they're able to add like 15 extra stories on top of the existing building. And those extra 15, they're then allowed to sell. The Indian government allows them to do that. But they have to move everybody back in and they have to have the same rent as they did before. And that's happening in New Delhi and Mumbai. So you're seeing this just giant boom in building. The building there is crazy, by the way. There's like bamboo scaffolding. People are welding in flip-flops. No OSHA to speak of. But they're getting it done quickly. And you're seeing it just everywhere. The real estate in somewhere like Mumbai, which used to be Bombay, is more expensive than New York because there's just no more of it there. In the cities, it's so crammed in. But once you get outside, it's still rural and still very village oriented.
I guess I always look at a little comparison for China. Let's ask first intellectual property thoughts. We know the Chinese have a history of reverse engineering something they may have picked up in the United States and built it for their own. Is that type of mentality there in India?
I don't believe so. No, okay. I really don't. It doesn't seem like they are. You know, there's still like a big push for a lot of people in India to get to the United States to study here. That seems to be a little bit waning in China. And again, I think they're more democratic. They're more like they want to be a partner. They're very open. Some of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. Whatever they have, they're willing to share. I went to a festival. It was fantastic. Actually made it in the paper. I just don't see that same, I don't even know what to call that from China, but it seems different from India.
Yeah.
And more accepting of Western culture and more wanting to assimilate, more wanting to partner, and that seems to be more their speed.
So then I guess I'll ask on the China, we hear about the younger folks are not wanting to live in the country and they want to live in the cities. Do you have either the same thing happening or the opposite of people getting out of the cities because it's so crowded in India?
No, it's the young people are moving to the cities, it feels like. But there's some, when I say smaller, I visited a city named Indore, and that's actually where our back office and our accounting is that's the reason for my trip. But it was like a city of like 2-3 million people, which is still pretty good size. But it was a very young city, and it was very tech related. It was very, and it boasts itself as the cleanest city in India. And that city was very young. And I think it's like a more of a mid-sized city, kind of like an Austin or Nashville, which seems to be popular in the United States. A lot of young people moving there. And maybe it's a little more affordable than Mumbai or New Delhi, much like the United States. It's very hard to move and pick up and go to LA or New York nowadays. It's too expensive. Although Austin and Nashville are rapidly approaching.
They're doing their part to contribute to the economy.
They sure are. Yeah. But you're getting like that, those smaller mid-sized cities they're attracting, but no, people definitely are leaving the countryside, in droves to go to university, in a place like Indore, or Mumbai and Delhi are still very popular, obviously.
I guess let's close it up like this, Jordan. As we look at, is there any comparison India is to another country? Has there been somebody else that's followed this template or somebody 50 years ago that, yep, here comes India. This is what happened in that country.
I would put it as the one that I would put it with, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but it feels like it is our neighbor to the south, Mexico. You know, they had... they've really come along, obviously. You know, if you look at Mexico's refining, you look at their agricultural, you look at their infrastructure, you look at telecommunications, you look at the internet, everything. It's, you know, I don't know the last time you're in Mexico, but if you go to a developed area of Mexico, it very much feels like you're in the United States. If you're in Cabo or Cancun or any of those, you're in the United States with a nice beach, right? Safe, everything like that. It's got its problems, but what country doesn't? Mm-hmm. But I would say it's like that, probably like a 50-year ago Mexico, where it used to be much more rural, and now we're seeing a lot of consolidation in Mexico City and all these other cities, Monterrey. You're seeing this consolidation and a willingness to work with us, with the United States. They're obviously one of our largest trade partners. I would hope that it goes that route.
Back to your day job with oil and energy. As we look in the new year of 2024, are we going to look at $5 a gallon gas? Are we going to see oil over WTI over 100? What's it going to take to get to that point? Or have we kind of stabilized where we're at?
I think it is completely dependent upon what happens in Israel and Gaza. And if it stays within Israel and Gaza, no, nothing. We've seen what's going to happen. We had a $9 jump, like I said, on the day of the attack from Hamas to Israel. $9 in one day, and now it's bled over of time. It's gone back down. We're basically at the starting point of what we were on that day, which was October 6th. Back to the start. The World Bank says if there's a medium-sized conflict in the Middle East, there will be about a 35% increase in crude oil. So that means if we get some smaller nations, maybe it's, I'm just going to throw it out there, Qatar or something like that. Probably it's not Qatar, but it's more like a Kuwait. If something gets involved there, or Lebanon or something like that, there's a better example, we're going to see a 35% increase. If for any reason Saudi Arabia or Iran gets any way involved in this, you will see $130 crude or something to that effect. How long it lasts, I don't know. These things usually come off pretty quickly after the dust settles. But that's the only way in the new year, Paul, I think you're going to see anything with $100 crude on it, is if you get either a smaller country or a larger country back involved. If it stays within those borders or trickles out a little bit, you're probably seeing $90, $95 tops.
Jordan Fife, good to see you again. Thank you for the time.
Paul, anytime. Thank you for having me.
My thanks to Jordan Fife, and thank you for watching. If you have any feedback for the podcast, send it my way at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. New episodes each and every Tuesday. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.